On August the 5th, 2015, The Guardian published a review of Stefano Mancuso and Alessandra Viola's popular science book, Brilliant Green. The book and the article make a solid case for the need to understand plants as possessing intelligence. Despite plants' lack of a brain, or more accurately, their structurally plural sentience, they are adept problem solvers in both evolutionary time, for example, Darwin's much-beloved orchids, and crucially, in everyday time, for example, tree roots that actively alter course to search for the best position to take in water, avoid competition, and garner chemicals. In Mancuso and Viola's view, this problem solving is clearly a kind of intelligence, of response, and not simply machinic reaction, and they are not alone in their argument. Brilliant Green is one of several popular works to explore various elements of plant intelligence and perception, meaning here perception by plants. For example, Daniel Chamovitz's 2012 What a Plant Knows explores the extensive biological research on plant sensation. He concludes from this research that plants are indisputably aware. Peter Wohlleben's 2015 The Hidden Life of Trees documents the sensuous lives and communicative networks of a German beech oak forest, noting, among other things, complex, mutualistic cross-species relationships. And Michael Pollan's widely read 23 article in The New Yorker not only details plant problem-solving strategies, which involve themselves, other plants, pollinators, and predators, but also makes a strong argument that these abilities nominate plants with a significant claim to ethical concern. On September 17, 2015, The Guardian published another article entitled We Need a Cure for Plant Blindness, meaning here people's perceptions of plants, specifically referring to the pronounced tendency of most people in the urbanized global north to not notice plants at all. We walk obliviously on them, by them, under them, and through them, unless they do something pretty dramatic to call our attention to them. For example, sorry to bring up this example, Michael's allergy to soy. So we became very attentive to the plant matter at that moment. As the article notes, especially in a horticultural industry increasingly geared to design over ecology, plants are treated like green wallpaper. They are understood as offsetting outdoor living decor and thus disposable as fashions change, rather than as participants in garden communities as active members of a shared ecology. The only other way many urban dwellers routinely interact with plants is in the process of preparing them to eat, which of course very seldom involves interaction with whole or living plant beings, let alone their complex relations of growing and dying. Is it any surprise that because so many people only interact with plants when they're already on a course directly toward death, that they find it difficult to see them as living beings rather than as the green backdrop of and raw material for human productive and consumer activity? These side-by-side Guardian moments of phytopolitics, broadly the involvement of plants in the modern multi-species biopolitics of life, implicating diverse plants, trees, ferns, flowering plants, grasses, shrubs, mosses in human lives, whether or not we recognize it, and also implicates diverse people and peoples, gatherers, agriculturalists, artists, botanists, gardeners, gourmets, taxonomists, bioprospectors in plant lives. It is, given human beings' complete dependence on plant lives for food, shelter, medicine, building material, warmth, indeed for life itself, hardly surprising that we have such a polyphony of different plant-human relationships. It is to me a source of great sadness that in capitalist modernity we generally pay so very little attention to those relationships. Indeed, I would go one step further and suggest that this contradiction is getting progressively more intense. At the same time as plants are increasingly recognized as sensuous, communicative, intelligent beings in the world, they're also subject to increasingly intensive mechanical, chemical, and biological intervention in order to render their lives ever more fully available to capitalist utilization. In order to explore this contradiction and in order to draw in some important perspectives that might complicate the rather monolithic we of Western modern humanity that I've just suggested, I've organized this talk as a series of four forays into phytopolitics, specifically four meditations on the practice and politics of vegetation. As opposed to presenting a single argumentative thread, I've intentionally followed what I see as a more plant-like form. Rather than a fugitive idea to be chased through multiple terrains, these shoots proceed plurally from their own places and form connections at their multiple moments of intertwining. In so doing, my hope is that you will find, rather than a large and persuasive point to take away, your own points of connection and phytopolitical inspiration. The first two forays might overlap slightly. The first one most certainly overlaps with Michael's work because it rests on it very extensively. But you will see that I progressively move away from that terrain as the paper moves along. Foray number one, I vegetate. Popularly, when people vegetate, they spend the weekend on the couch in flannel pajamas in a monster binge of multiple seasons of The Bridge. Or at least, I have been known to do that. When people vegetate persistently, their brain stems keep basic functions going, circulation, respiration, digestion, but they don't generally display what we like to think of as consciousness and function. They are considered alive and cannot be killed or let die without a lot of legal wrangling, but they don't demonstrate certain kinds of awareness or independent capability that are considered emblematic of human living. Even more, as Mark Twain wrote in The Innocents Abroad, vegetating is directly opposed to activity, to citizenship, and to cosmopolitanism. Broad, wholesome, charitable views of men and things cannot be acquired by vegetating in one little corner of the earth all one's lifetime. In contrast, when plants or fungi or viruses vegetate, they are understood to grow prolifically, even abnormally quickly. According to the Oxford English Dictionary, plants vegetate both intransitively and transitively. They vegetate by growing, as in the annual rhythms of vegetation and senescence or death that are common among temperate angiosperms. And they are also vegetated by cultivators who create landscapes by establishing particular plants to grow in particular locations with particular results. Plants also vegetate intransitively by propagating asexually. Witness the vegetative rhizomatic growth of trembling aspens in the middle of North America that spread on a pretty cosmopolitan scale, creating one of the largest and oldest single organisms on the planet, known as Pando, 6,600 tons, 80,000 years old. When people and animals vegetate, they are considered largely inert, alive, but not quite fully. When plants and other non-animal organisms do likewise, they are considered abundantly alive, perhaps even excessively so. Etymology makes things even more complicated. The English word vegetate dates from the early 17th century and means simply to grow as plants do. The sense of leading an inert, passive life employed by Twain emerged later in the mid-18th century, not accidentally, at about the same time as the beginning of the modern sciences. The word originates, however, in the Latin, to be active, and applies intransitively and transitively, actively and passively, singularly and plurally to a range of persons, plants, and other beings, including the active first person human singular, vegeo, I am lively, I am active, I excite, I arouse. To understand this paradox, Martyr might direct us to the Greeks, whose thinking on questions of life and living has exerted and continues to exert a powerful influence on Western metaphysics. Very briefly, for Aristotle, there are three kinds of living force, or soul, or psyche: growth, nutrition, and reproduction, nutritive or vegetative soul, perception, sensation, and locomotion, sensitive soul, and thought and intellect, rational soul. Hierarchically arranged, plants are at the lowest level and display the activities suitable to vegetable beings, those of the nutritive soul. Up the ladder, then, animals display sensitive soul and only human beings rational soul. However, these activities are cumulative, meaning that beings higher up the scale, and forgive my recapitulation of the hierarchy, but beings higher up the scale demonstrate both their own forms of activity and those of the beings below them. Humans, for example, have sensitive and nutritive desires as well as rational ones. In this sense, when people vegetate, they are not so much being passive as demonstrating those activities that are consistent with the vegetal undergrowth of their psuche: growth, nutrition, reproduction, and decay. Reflecting on vegetating then, which would perhaps no longer quite be vegetating, even if we can access vegetal desire directly when we're thirsty, reflecting on vegetating could indicate a practice through which people might come to feel the pulsing vibrations of our plant selves, our kinship with plants, our common enactments of liveliness, something almost completely foreign to our habitual instrumentalization of the entire plant kingdom as wholly other, largely inert, and unquestionably consumable. Of course, I rather like this idea, but I'm getting ahead of myself. The fact that vegetating is considered an active part of the human psyche in different places in the history of Western philosophy, as Michael has also pointed out in his book, The Philosopher's Plant, I will give you a plug every time I need to, does not mean that vegetating is necessarily valued in this schema any more than it is in modern, more taxonomic understandings. Plants remain at the bottom of the ladder of living for Aristotle, and scholars as diverse as Alighieri, Hegel, and Arendt confirm his anthropocentric understanding, in which thinking and acting thoughtfully is always already understood as a higher form of living than vegetating, because it enacts the noblest elements of the human's tripartite soul, because it demonstrates an orientation of growth to a higher teleological purpose in the dialectical upward progression of spirit, and or because it enables the individual person to conduct a reflective dialogue with herself in order to move beyond the biological exigencies of bodily survival. Don't get me wrong, especially given recent events in world history, I'm a big fan of thinking. With Arendt, I firmly believe that allowing the mind to withdraw from the phenomenal processual world of vegetating and animating for a while in order to reflect on it is a necessary, if not unfortunately sufficient, preventative of tyrannies, both totalitarian and banal. To the sound of Arendt writhing in her grave, however, I ask, is it, however, really necessary to demean the form of living that is vegetating in the process of defending, reasoning, reflecting, and understanding? Is a recognition of our own vegetative life as such, an understanding, however tentative and fleeting, of our own constitutive plantiness, necessarily a capitulation to couch potato dung? As we heard this morning, Michael doesn't think so. In his 2013 book, Plant Thinking, he includes the important observation that plants encourage us to imagine a form of living that is not always predicated on the central assumption of an individual self in encounter with discrete others. The plant is indifferent to the distinction between the inner and the outer. It is literally locked in itself, but in such a way that it merges with the external environment to which it is completely beholden. Elaine Miller makes a similar point in her 2002 book, The Vegetative Soul, which follows vegetation through 19th century German idealism and romanticism. Here, the vegetative soul, in contrast to the animated soul, emphasizes rootedness, vulnerability, interdependence, and transformative possibility, rather than a separation of soul from body, actualization, and a stance of aggressiveness and self-preservation. Karen Hull emphasizes that terrestrial plants are in their environments, earth and air, in ways that are both quantitatively and qualitatively different from mammalian forms of inhabitation. They are both landscape and in the landscape. And Teresa Kelly, following similar philosophical tendrils, spends a delightful chapter of her 2012 book, Clandestine Marriage, pitting Hegel against Goethe in an extended duel between vegetative desire and teleological orientation. For every subordination of nutritive growth to the individual and intellectual dictates of spirit, she parries via Goethe with a defense of the individuality, particularity, and metamorphosis of the plant form and the contingent unsystematic energy of nature in general. Vegetation flourishes in these arguments because the process of thinking like a plant reveals to us what we've chosen to forget in dominant philosophical and scientific imaginations of our human selves as primarily rational, self-organizing, and independent beings over and above all others. A sense of our profound dependence on and location in the conditions of our growth and decay, including the other beings with whom we share the elements of liveliness. To vegetate, then, potentially suggests a thinking response to our plantiness. This kind of work involves not only thinking about plants as objects of attention and reflection, given widespread plant blindness, that's still not a bad place to start, but also thinking with plants and consequently with and in the environments, as we also discussed the morning, from which plants are not really separate. I vegetate, you vegetate, we vegetate. Despite the inevitable difficulties of representation and debates about ethical action that will no doubt adhere to any project of thinking like, with, and as plants, it seems to me that it is ecologically important to reflect on the ways in which we are constituted by vegetal desires that both connect us with and remind us of our shared aliveness with vegetation. Although vegetating doesn't presume a specific right course of action toward particular plants, such as demanding the inclusion of plants in privileged liberal discourses of rights, in fact, I would argue, and I think you would argue, that it suggests the exact opposite, it most certainly suggests an attentive and lively practice in which possibilities for ecological kinship are able to germinate, proliferate, and even effloresce. Foray number two, vegetative biopolitics. Despite important criticisms of his anthropocentrism, Michel Foucault remains a key interlocutor in contemporary thinking about multi-species biopolitics. As he writes in The History of Sexuality, Volume 1, for millennia, man remained what he was for Aristotle, a living animal with the additional capacity for political existence. Modern man is an animal whose politics places his existence as a living being in question. What is important to note here is that for Foucault, it is precisely the embodied animality of humans, our shared biological capacities for living and dying, that can be harnessed directly by forces of power, primarily oriented to bodies rather than, say, to consciousnesses, that renders us biopolitical subjects. Although, as Nicole Shukin and others have pointed out, this human animalization does not mean that animals are generally well treated in biopolitical relations. Some animals are highly regarded and become human-like in law and policy and popular culture, even as others are exploited, enslaved, and killed en masse. But it does mean that matters of life and organismic kinship, including ecological standing, potentially come to the fore in new ways. Humans become biological beings, and other biological beings begin to look more like us as a result. Animal suffering, for example, emerges as an important ethical and political concern in the same context as laboratory rats are considered useful models for human reactions to medication. We are understood to share elements of physiology, response, and affect as living beings, and to function optimally or wither, to make live or let die, in response to similar kinds of variables. As Jeffrey Neilan writes in his provocative intervention into biopolitical understanding, it is thus not the animal that is abjected and excluded from modern understandings of life, but the plant. Animals do not function in modernity as are others because we are so powerfully rendered animal ourselves. Instead, what remains in the sphere of absolute otherness is the vegetal. Following Foucault's reading, Neilan writes, one might suggest that the role of abjected other as having been played throughout the biopolitical era is not by the animal, but by the plant, which was indeed forgotten as the privileged form of life at the dawn of biopower. In other words, he argues, it is important not just to trace the ways in which Western thinkers have historically subdivided life by contrasting humans with animals, as is, for example, Giorgio Agamben's project in The Open, but also to examine how we currently and institutionally organize our planetary preeminence by equating meaningful life, bios, with animality, and expendable mere life, or zoe, with vegetality. And here, Michael and I don't agree entirely. More precisely, continental philosophy, the main subject of Neilan's inquiry, remains largely opposed to a consideration of the ways in which plants, as plants, enact, complicate, and model life and living in a biopolitical era. Despite, for example, Deleuze and Guattari's multiple invocations of the rhizome as a mode of non-teleological subjectivity, the metaphor doesn't entirely get at the actual conditions of vegetation in neoliberal biopolitical capitalism. In this moment, Neelan argues, the vegetable suke of life is a concept or image of thought that far better characterizes our biopolitical present than does the human animal image of life, which remains tethered to the organism, the individual being. For Neelan, following Deleuze, vegetative rhizomaticity diagnoses the territory of neoliberal capitalism, in which power operates through lines of flight and strategies of deterritorialization. For me, following Plants, I wonder if this territory doesn't also demand that we start to think of ourselves as living in an era that not only intervenes in our human and animal souls, rationality, subjectivation, perception, and discipline, but also in our vegetal ones, in the realms of nutrition, growth, and decay, in other words, in our growing, eating, thirsting, reproducing, senescing, decaying, and composting bodies. This is another interpenetration of Michael's talk. And what was the word that you chose? Bio, I've forgotten. You had a word to describe the way in which we are being rendered plant.
The biodegradability.
Nope, never mind. It will happen. But I had an aha moment when you said that. Plants are clearly treated badly in neoliberal biopolitics. Think, for example, of the ways in which so-called terminator technologies are employed by multinational agri-corporations specifically to deny plants the ability to reproduce of their own accord by producing fertile seeds to spawn a new generation. In addition to the fact that such technologies deprive farmers of the ability to collect and save seeds for future planting, which is the prima facie point of the technology, they also intervene directly into plants' bodies in order to render their properties of growth and reproduction as sites for profit and accumulation as fully as possible. Plants are intensively hybridized, genetically altered, forcibly vegetated and germinated, and tightly controlled with chemicals on a massive scale, their specific capacities patented in order to serve particular accumulative ends. From attempts to hybridize and or regulate against open pollination to direct genetic and chemical manipulation of specific cultivars in order to create vegetal forms that serve specific consumer desires. Strawberries in Canada and probably Sweden in February that taste somewhat like strawberries. Precisely the quality of vegetation is harnessed to capitalist accumulation. Hence, I propose the vegetariat. Capitalist accumulation is not possible without the ever-intensifying exploitation of the surplus labor of plants. Intensive abuse of plants is the rule, even in a universe that has begun to question the widespread exploitation of animals, because we still don't largely consider plant lives as meaningful. Again, this is not to say that I think we should pursue anything that looks like plant rights in response to this exploitation. In fact, rather than imagine that plants should be granted ethical status on the basis of, say, their potential capacities for pain and suffering, which is Michael Pollan's argument in that New Yorker article, we might instead consider the ways in which people and animals are increasingly organized and controlled like and even as plants, in which our bodies are caught along with theirs in a web of relation in which our plantiest capacities are at stake, demanding a political response, a response to our shared vegetariatization rather than an ethically extensionist one. Our capacities for nutrition, growth, and reproduction are the vectors of intervention in current economic and policy debates about proper life and living. People are not only animalized, but people and animals are also vegetated, treating as beings whose most plant-like capacities are the stuff of the greatest concern. I think the anti-abortion movement is a perfect example of this. Quite aside from questions of perception, sensation, and rationality in this era, what is at the forefront of current debate is where and when and how we are to live as reproducing productive bodies who matter and cause concern as a result of being simply alive, growing, populating, spreading, invading, vegetating. In this context, the large cluster of recent popular works on plant intelligence gives me some pause. On the one hand, I'm very pleased to see plants get recognition for the important work they do to, keep life going, including but not only under capitalism. and also for the ways in which they participate as complex, sensate, and interactive beings in the process. In fact, so much so that the line drawn between vegetal and animal forms of liveliness no longer really holds firm, if it ever really did. According to Mancuso and Viola, with whom I began this talk, a compelling body of research shows that higher order plants really are intelligent, able to receive signals from their environment, process the information, and devise solutions adapted to their own survival. Further, their intelligence is both singular and collective. They manifest a kind of swarm intelligence that enables them to behave not as an individual, but as a multitude. On the other hand, however, this research is all too often easily parlayed into new forms of control and appropriation. Understanding and harnessing collective vegetal intelligence here becomes another mode of biopolitical intervention into life, as, for example, plant signaling chemistry comes to be used in new agricultural, communicative, and even robotic technologies. As Mancuso and Viola themselves enthuse, for some time now, there's been talk of plant-inspired robots, a real generation of planetoids. Plans are also underway for the construction of plant-based networks with the capacity to use plants as ecological switchboards and make available on the internet in real time the parameters that are continuously monitored by the roots and leaves. Soon, the plant internet, aka the wood wide web, may become part of everyday life for all of us. All of us in and as the vegetariat. That plants have intelligence isn't really a new understanding. That plants are understood to have intelligence in much the same biological manner as animals and humans is, however, a relatively recent incorporation of vegetation into popular discourses of animation and cogitation that were once considered the sole realm of Homo sapiens. I don't mean to suggest that it's a bad idea to think about plants as intelligent. I do mean to think that it's a mistake to equate the understanding of plants as intelligent, responsive beings with the idea that this conception will mean that plants will benefit, or that an understanding of shared vegetative intelligence is necessarily liberatory for either plants or people. Human beings have become plants in the biopolitical age. We are members of a species, population, race, sex, group, vector, heredity. This incorporation, despite the desires of some new materialists, has not spelt better treatment for people. Animals have become people in the manner that people are now animals, beings that can suffer, emote, relate. This treatment has spawned some new ethical responses to animals, but only within a very limited range. And now, plants. It's an open question. Foray number three, the vegetarian. Han Kang's extraordinary, disturbing novel, The Vegetarian, translated by Deborah Smith, won the Man Booker International Prize for 2016. Originally written in Korean as three separate novellas, the work explores the life of a young woman, Yong Hye, through three overlapping stories about her, that of her husband, whom we know only as Mr. Chong, that of her older sister In-hye's husband, who is never named, and that of sister In-hye herself. These are all, crucially, perspectives that do not afford us much access to Yong-hye's interior life, even if each one embodies a particular desire for her life. The Vegetarian begins with the voice of Mr. Chong. Before my wife turned vegetarian, I'd always thought of her as completely unremarkable in every way. It ends with In-hye in an ambulance with her sister near the rural psychiatric hospital in which Yong-hye has been incarcerated because of her eventual refusal to eat anything at all. Quietly, In-hye breathes in. The trees by the side of the road are blazing, green fire, undulating like the rippling flanks of a massive animal, wild and savage. She stares fiercely at the trees as if waiting for an answer, as if protesting against something. The look in her eyes is dark and insistent. Over the course of The Vegetarian, Yong-hye attempts to become a plant. The trees at whom In-hye stares are her rivals in the struggle for Yong-hye's intimacy and identity. The first section of the book begins with Yong-hye's sudden refusal, based on a dream, to eat all animal products. This act infuriates Mr. Chong. He is disturbed not as much by the choice itself as he is by her sudden burst of remarkability. Her refusal to provide a banal excuse of health or weight loss, and the fact that her vegetarianism thus casts a pall over him in the eyes of his boss and his co-workers. It also infuriates Yonghye's father, who, in the midst of a family meal orchestrated to entice her back into the carnivorous world via a profusion of childhood meat delicacies, loses his temper, slaps her across the face, and, with the aid of his son-in-law, violently attempts to stuff a piece of pork in her mouth. In response, she slashes her wrist with a fruit knife and is hospitalized. She escapes confinement and is found outside, exposing her naked chest to the winter sun. The second section of the book begins 2 years later, with Inhye's husband, a filmmaker, obsessing about an image on a poster of a dance performance in which men and women sat displaying their naked backs, which were covered nape to sacrum with flowers, coiling stems and thickly overlapping petals, painted on in red and blue. He is determined to make a film of what he really wanted the dance performance to be, an extended sexual encounter among these men and women, among these flowers, to become one body, a hybrid of plant, animal, and human. Perhaps because he also sees in Yonghye a certain plantiness, quote, she radiated energy like a tree that grows in the wilderness, denuded and solitary, he feels compelled to have her perform in the film and also to play a role himself. He persuades her, paints her naked body with bright flowers, films her, and eventually has sex with her, himself also painted, on film. Here is one of his descriptions of her painted. This was the body of a beautiful young woman, conventionally an object of desire, and yet it was a body from which all desire had been eliminated. But this was nothing so crass as carnal desire, not for her, rather, or so it seemed, what she had renounced was the very life that her body represented. The sunlight that came splintering through the wide window, dissolving into grains of sand, and the beauty of that body, which, though this was not visible to the eye, was also ceaselessly splintering, the overwhelming inexpressibility of the scene beat against him like a wave breaking on the rocks. The connection that Kong draws between men's violences against women, especially sexual violences, and the violences that are routinely performed against animals and plants is not a new one. Still, the repulsive intertwining of violence and desire in both the meat and the sex scenes is extremely powerful, made more complex and more disturbing by our almost complete lack of access to Yonghye's thoughts and actions. It would be a mistake that Mr. Chong also makes, to say that Yonghye responds passively to these violences. In fact, I would like to argue that she responds very actively, but often in the manner of a plant, or perhaps more accurately here, in the direction of a plant. Rather than run out the door of her parents' home after spitting out the pork, she cuts into herself, her blood confirming her animality, which she then confounds when she sits half-naked in the sun outside the hospital. As Inhye's husband wonders to himself, why did you bare your breasts to the sunlight like some kind of mutant animal that has evolved to be able to photosynthesize? And rather than counter his attempts to turn her precisely into a mutant human-animal-plant hybrid object, conceptually, aesthetically, physically, and sexually, she actively embraces her dehumanization. Although she never expresses overtly sexual desire, her body is articulately fluid. In addition, when he attempts to have sex with her before painting himself with flowers, she refuses and speaks directly about her refusal as a form of vegetal desire. Here, he has just filmed her having sex with someone else, painted. Why shouldn't we? Because I'm your brother-in-law? No, it's nothing to do with that. Then why not? It wasn't him, it was the flowers. The flowers? I really wanted to do it, she said carefully. I have never wanted it so much before. It was the flowers on his body. I couldn't help myself. That's all. Except in these brief instances of her speech and activity, she speaks very little. The only places in the novel in which we have access to Yonghye's own experiences are a series of italicized insertions into Mr. Chong's story at the beginning of the book. These insertions are her dreams, the ones that compelled her to stop eating meat, and also fragments of her impressions of what is happening to her. These small glimpses of her interiority coagulate around her experience of being possessed by meat and by death. She describes dreams and memories of barbecuing and eating meat. She remembers dreams of murder in which only the violence is vivid enough to stick, multiply involving the deaths and desired deaths of animals. She remembers feeling calmed by the taste of her own blood in her mouth when she cuts her finger while mincing meat. And she describes an overwhelming feeling of being occupied by the bodies of the animals that she's eaten. Blood and flesh, all those butchered bodies are scattered in every nook and cranny, and though the physical remains were excreted, their lives still stick stubbornly to my insides. Her final direct words to the reader at the point where she's at the hospital just before she goes outside to photosynthesize are, "I want to throw myself through the pitch-black window. Maybe that would finally get this lump of flesh out of my body. Yes, perhaps that might work. No one can help me. No one can save me. Nobody can make me breathe." The third section of The Vegetarian, told from Sister Inhye's perspective, revolves around Yonghye's incarceration in a psychiatric hospital because she has completely stopped eating. We are with Inhye in her loving fight for her sister, but Yonghye's voice continues to haunt us. Inhye struggles with what she can only understand as Yonghye's mental illness, and also with her response to discovering her husband and sister painted with flowers, post-coital, and with trying to keep her own life together in the wake of her divorce, including taking care of her son. There's a lot to say about Inhye. She is, like her sister, caught up in a world of very gendered violences. But the moment in her story that I want to focus on concerns Yonghye on her journey to becoming plant. Inhye has brought food to the hospital, like her mother, lovingly prepared in order to entice Yonghye into eating, but respectfully only including fruits and vegetables, and her offering has been rebuked. "Sister, you don't need to bring that stuff now," Yonghye smiled. "I don't need to eat anymore." And then she recounts to Inhye, "I thought trees stood up straight. They actually stand with both arms in the earth, all of them. Look, look over there. Aren't you surprised?" Yonghye sprang up and pointed to the window. "All of them. They're standing on their heads." Yonghye laughed frantically. Inhye remembered a moment from their childhood when Yonghye's face had worn the same expression as it did now. Those moments when her sister's single-lidded eyes would narrow and turn completely dark, when that innocent laughter would come out of her mouth. "Do you know how I found out? Well, I was in a dream, and I was standing on my head. Leaves were growing from my body, and roots were sprouting from my hands, so I dug down into the earth, on and on. I wanted flowers to bloom from my crotch, so I spread my legs. I spread them wide." Yonghye's desire to become a plant threatens her life as a human animal. She renounces speech as well as eating. As she says to Inhye, "Soon now words and thoughts will all disappear. Just wait a little longer, sister." Clearly on a joyous path toward her own death. Hong Kong asks us with great intensity to experience Inhye's distress as her sister starves herself. At the same time, she also leads us into something of Yonghye's vegetally expressed desire to remove herself from particularly human forms of violence. An industrial and gourmet culture of meat eating, her father's extensive abuse, Mr. Chong's mistaking of her plant-like unremarkability for feminine passivity, her brother-in-law's manipulation of her sexual desire for his ends, and perhaps more, perhaps even the anthropogenic climate change that haunts the novel's margins. For Yonghye, then, becoming plant is more than an affirming embrace of vegetality as a form of plantiness that might express itself in human life. It is an embodied response to the multi-species gendered politics of life in patriarchal neoliberal capitalism, in which becoming plant may be a form of desired escape from modes of subjectivity and relationship predicated on killing and consuming the bodies of others on a massive industrial scale. With Yonghye, we might then ask ourselves, what does it mean to think and feel with and even as plants in these conditions? Foray number four, vegetation restoration. I'm walking through a grove of very old Douglas fir trees on the southeastern tip of Vancouver Island, British Columbia, Canada, in the place that was ancestrally and is now again known as Pecos. In Tsangkhoten, the language of the Saanich people indigenous to this place, Pecos means white head, possibly referring to the fact that the place was the last from which the glaciers receded from Vancouver Island. For about 160 years, the place was also known by colonizers as Mount Douglas, but after a different Douglas. The trees are large, brown, wet, thick, textured, imposing. There are enormous sword ferns everywhere in the understory, green, dense, reaching, enclosing. It is winter, and everything drips. The trees, ferns, salal, and Oregon grape shine slickly green against the pewter sky. Coast Douglas firs typically live to be over 750 years old and can reach 90 meters in height. Ethnobotanist Nancy Turner has spent her career collecting and cultivating West Coast First Nations stories about plants. According to her collaborators, Saanich people, who call them Jisse, have used them extensively for thousands of years. Their thick bark is an excellent hot-burning fuel. Their durable wood can be crafted into all manner of useful things like poles for salmon weirs. Their prolific and sticky pitch can be used as a cement to patch canoes and water containers, and also as a salve for wounds. Starting in earnest in the 19th century, others of the fir's property made them the most important industrial tree species on North America's west coast, Vancouver Island included. Their immense size and straight, strong, tightly grained wood made them ideal as building material, and in places like Pecos, their proximity to the ocean made them easily accessible commodities. There are almost no old-growth Coast Douglas firs left as a result. One study estimated that only 0.5%, about 1,100 hectares, of the low coastal plain is covered by relatively undisturbed old forests. Environmental organizations like the Ancient Forest Alliance are thus determined to preserve what few are left, such as at the Edinburgh Mountain Ancient Forest, part of which has already been industrially clear-cut, leaving behind the second largest Douglas fir on record, nicknamed Big Lonely Doug, a fine figure of charismatically tragic megaflora. There is some protected second growth, as at Pecos, but large areas of coastal forest have been converted into tree farms, or more accurately, fiber farms, in which a clear-cut forest is slash-burned to get rid of the snags and stumps, replanted, and harvested again once the trees have reached a marketable size. The massive commodification of Douglas firs is a stunning example of the ways in which plants are often the vegetal foundations of both capitalism and colonialism. Indeed, the so-called Douglas Treaties, imposed on South Coast First Nations by the colony's first governor, were very explicitly oriented to getting First Nations communities, including their ancestral and ongoing plant knowledges, out of the way in order to make the land and its resources as available as possible for simple extraction. Treated as individual units whose value is estimated almost entirely in terms of board feet of timber, the trees cannot be anything other than resource as standing reserve, the vegetariat written especially large. It's interesting, then, that environmental organizations like the Ancient Forest Alliance and eco-luminaries such as David Suzuki have sought to develop greater public respect for the trees by portraying their modes of living up the vitality hierarchy, emphasizing their singularity, individuality, and even quasi-personhood. So there's Doug, there's Luna of Julia Butterfly Hill fame, and there's also the rather anthropomorphized individual portrayed arbobiographically in Suzuki's One Tree, A Life Story, which is simultaneously a very knowledgeable foray into ecological interconnectivity in coastal forests and a striking example of the ongoing tendency to think of certain trees as exceptions to the heroic exceptions to the multiplicity, contextuality, and lack of self-boundedness that characterizes vegetation. For example, Aristotle allowed that trees have a telos, Deleuze and Guattari specifically contrast the rhizomatic with the arborescent, and Suzuki's is neither the first nor the last work in the arbobiographical genre. Research like Peter Wohlleben's, however, suggests that Douglas firs are not at all heroically singular. It also emphasizes that thinking about the tree's value in terms of the particular commodity they are understood to embody misses almost all of what's going on in their lives and communities, quite literally a matter of not seeing the forest for the trees. What is going on, of course, is vegetating. As University of British Columbia biologist Suzanne Simard, for example, has documented extensively, Douglas firs are active participants in a complex subterranean network of mycorrhiza, in which roots and fungi engage in an elaborate process of chemical symbiosis. The trees give photosynthesized carbon to the fungi, and the fungi transmit inaccessible soil nutrients back to the trees. As the fungus spreads, it also links tree to plant to tree, not just Douglas firs, all of them, creating a vast interconnected forest network in which trees also communicate carbon to each other, each according to their needs, from each according to their abilities. I had to get the vegetarian required that. In this context, thinking of a tree as a singular and person-like being grossly misrepresents the fact that even though Douglas firs germinate from seed and grow progressively larger from that origin in the manner of an individual, they are also inextricably linked to rhizomatic soil fungi so much that it would be impossible to have the tree without the fungus. Here, it is not the trees that represent the forest at all. Mycorrhizal fungi are considered to be the keynote creatures of Coast Douglas fir forests, meaning that what tends to be valued in the forest, old trees as singular lives, bored feet of timber as sources of profit, is not at all related to what is most lively in the forest, and also that what is most lively might be something that is less easily anthropomorphized or utilized, at least for now. It behooves us, then, not to imagine for a second that we give rightful value to plants by making them appear like us. Walking at Picoles, I try instead to imagine my connection to the vegetal liveliness of the forest by connecting into the network of mycorrhizal relationships that define and sustain this place, by becoming plural, attending to the decentered vegetality of the forest as it resonates with my own multiplicity, by paying attention to the ways in which insects, birds, and mammals also plurally interact with the trees and fungi and other plants, mosses, and lichens, in an extraordinary dance of sustenance and relationship, and by imagining what it means for me, a white settler colonist used to treating this place as a park, to be part of these relationships rather than just an admiring observer of their exuberant greenness. Anthropologist Eduardo Cohn might allow that I am trying to think with the forest. Forests are good to think with, he writes, because they themselves think. I want to take this seriously. Or perhaps I am trying to think as a forest, as part of the we that is our collective vegetal psyche. Conceiving of complex multi-species forms of biosemiotic relationality as thought for Cohn does not mean that we all think in similar ways or that I can ever remotely apprehend a mycorrhizal umwelt. What it does mean is that by understanding myself as participating in the lively, thoughtful interactivity of the forest as a self among selves, I might be able to see my own relationships to plants and others as ecologically embedded and myself as something other than a fiber user, or even mycorrhiza user if the wood wide web pans out. Perhaps even as mindfully and multiply vegetating among the many others who are doing the same. Potawatomi botanist Robin Wall Kimmerer sums it up quite beautifully in one chapter of her book Braiding Sweetgrass, in which she describes replanting sweetgrass on a property in the Mohawk Valley in the U.S. state of Pennsylvania. The place, Kanatsioharika, is a lovely and thoughtful re-inhabitation of a site that was an ancient Haudenosaunee Bear Clan village. An attempt to wrest the land from white botanical settlement, it is now largely populated with timothy, clover, and daisies, and white settler racism. It is very intentionally an antidote to the cultural genocide perpetrated at the nearby Carlisle Indian Industrial School. Kimmerer describes the science of restoring sweetgrass relations in this place. The most vigorous stands of sweetgrass are the ones tended by basket makers. Reciprocity is a key to success. When the sweetgrass is cared for and treated with respect, it will flourish. But if the relationship fails, so does the plant. what we contemplate here is more than ecological restoration. It is the restoration of a relationship between plants and people. We are dreaming of a time when the land might give thanks for the people. For Kimmerer, planting sweetgrass is an act of vegetal decolonization, participating in an ongoing ritual of planting, harvesting, and respectful use that draws on the precise vegetal properties of sweetgrass, which mostly spreads rhizomatically, and the ancestrally storied agricultural practices of particular people who know collectively how and where to plant and harvest the grass in order to make the best use of these properties, in order to achieve something like flourishing for all concerned, in order to loosen the hold of colonial vegetalities, both physically and spiritually. To plant sweetgrass here is to engage in restorative relationship, an attentive intertwining of the capacities of people and plants in concert, in a mode that, at least potentially, defies the compulsion to capitalist extraction and accumulation. Knowledge about plants that emerges from embodied, thoughtful, storied engagement with particular plants in particular places over a long period of time is what both Kimmerer and Turner champion in their ethnobotanical activism. For Turner, who helps the Saanich people to plant camas, a nutrient-rich bulb that is every bit as important to them as sweetgrass is to the Haudenosaunee, this act of relational botanizing is not about somehow restoring the land to a mythical pre-contact paradisial wilderness, as if colonization could be reversed. It's about turning one's labor to the cultivation of multi-species relationships of reconciliation. Although I'm very much smitten with the truly beautiful and inspirational project of reaching toward my own plantiness, of thinking like and as a plant, I loved the yoga. The key question in my vegetative practice is not so much one of how I might become like a plant or even as a plant. It is one of what and who I am to plants. What kinds of relationships do I have to the plants with whom I share a garden, a city, an ecology, a supply chain, a world? How might I have obligations to them and to the flourishing of our relationships together? How are these relationships part of a larger constellation, one that also includes animals and a whole range of different people to whom I'm conjoined along with the plants in conditions that are not of our own choosing? How can I choose to practice these budding relationships of reconciliation, literally against the grain of a neoliberal capitalist metabolism that intensively subjects all of our lives to the increasingly catastrophic logic of accumulation? I'm not sure I have an answer, but I do hold out hope that perhaps we can vegetate together, even in the complicated, violent, capitalist mycorrhizal landscapes of Douglas fir forests. I'm not quite sure what this collective vegetating is going to look like, but I do know that it will involve attending closely to a complex web of relationships that extends well beyond, or beneath, colonial, patriarchal, capitalist, extractive approaches to Douglas firs and their communities, to human-plant entanglements as they involve us in a deep metabolism that is not always already opened to extractivism. Thank you.